Thanks, everyone, for coming. My name's John Hamilton. This is Norm Stockwell. Norm is with WORT Community Radio in Madison. And I'm also from Madison, Wisconsin, where I've worked at WORT as a volunteer for some time. And lately, since the beginning of this year, I've been involved in a project called the Workers' Independent News Service to bring labor news to working people in the United States. Mimi, get up here. Also, it's weird. I'm having some kind of terrible allergy attack. It's never happened to me. It must be all the fresh air up here. I'm not used to it, right? Well, we all know about some certain corporate crooks by the name of Skilling and Ken Lay. We've heard of these people, right? People who have absconded with hundreds of millions of dollars from their corporations. We've heard about the five officials at Adelphia Communications who used the corporate treasury as their personal piggy bank. They made off with millions of dollars. They bought the Buffalo Sabres professional hockey team, private golf course for themselves. Maybe you've heard of Samuel Waxall, the CEO of ImClone Corporation, who he got an inside tip that the FDA was about to reject his drug a couple days before they actually did it. Tipped off his family and friends. Even Martha Stewart, apparently, may have been involved in this. Maybe you've heard of Dennis Kozlowski, who at first was under investigation for funneling artwork through his Manhattan pad with corporate funds. And it turns out that he's stolen a total of $135 million from, from Tyco International, a conglomerate company that he helped start. On one trip to Italy for his wife's 40th birthday, they spent a week in the Mediterranean on a yacht at a cost of $2 million. This came directly out of the corporate coffers. They flew in Jimmy Buffett to personally entertain them. Maybe you've heard of WorldCom, a corporation whose only business strategy was to acquire other telecommunications companies. And every time they did that, they would, you know, falsify their profits to make the stock margins. Maybe we've heard about these stories recently, and maybe we've heard from the president or the vice president that these are a few bad apples that have spoiled the bunch. Well, in fact, these people have drained the stock market of $8 trillion. I think was the latest estimate I saw. Which might not be such a bad thing, except that a lot of working people have their retirement savings invested in there, and they've lost everything. And when corporations go bankrupt, they're the first to lose everything. and the way I see it, there have been a total of eight people indicted so far, nobody in jail at this point. So the way I see it, if you're a corporate executive, it takes about $1 trillion of loss for you to actually wind up behind bars. But
right.
I want to know what separates these people from the rest of the corporate crooks who are not under indictment, who don't face charges. People like the Walton family, the heirs to Sam Walton's fortune, the Walmart empire. They're number 5 through 10 on the Fortune list of the richest people on earth. Each one of them controls over $10 billion. Here's a corporation that is built on the exploitation of its workforce from the sweatshops in China and Indonesia and Mexico and all around the global south where their cheap products are produced to the workers here in the United States who get no benefits, often put in time on the clock that is not recorded, for which they're not paid. And when they try to form a union, when they try to organize to enforce their rights, they're crushed. I look to the example in Texas. The UFCW has been trying for years to organize Walmarts across the United States. There was a meat department at a Walmart superstore, which included, you know, a grocery in Texas. And the meat cutters there organized into UFCW. And when it was obvious to Walmart, the corporation, that these folks were going to win and that eventually they might have to sit down and bargain with these workers, What did they do? Did they follow the law? No. They closed that department, but they didn't just close that meat department. They closed down every single meat department in every single Walmart in the United States, thousands of them. That's a story that's not getting out. And these are the stories of corporate corruption that we don't hear on a daily basis. I mean, we don't hear about chief executives who downsize 10, 20, 50,000 people on a whim. In fact, these people are celebrated. They're lauded in the business pages and on CNN Financial News. And that's what is so lacking in the United States today, is meaningful discussion in our mass media, in our newspapers, on the radio, news about working Americans. And you'd certainly think that that there's an audience for it. 70-odd percent of us, you know, punch a card for a living. And these are the people who are sorely lacking in the mass media. So what I want to talk about, and what I think all of us want to talk about today, is how we can get microphones into the hands of working people in the United States and around the world, and get these critical voices on the air. I know that Mimi's been working on this for a lot longer than I have at Building Bridges at WBAI in New York. Norm Stockwell's been doing it. Of course, we have the WINS Project, Workers Independent News Service. But it's amazing to think how many business sections and business news, sections in newspapers and business channels we have in the United States, and just how few labor voices there are out there. And we really need to address this, and especially us as grassroots community radio activists, we need to find ways to bridge the gap, to build bridges, right?
Thank you for the plug.
I guess I'll tell you a little bit about WINS, and then I'll turn it over to Mimi. WINS, the Workers Independent News Service, was the brainchild of some labor and media activists in Madison, Wisconsin, around WRT Community Radio. Sort of formed out of labor radio, which is a program which began as a biweekly 15-minute labor news program, at a certain weird time in the morning.
Don't steal my part, John.
Oh, I'm sorry. I won't get too far into that. And then expanded to a half-hour a week program. And from there, because the model was so successful at pooling together all of the resources of organized labor and working people in Madison, and actually getting mini disc recorders into the hands of trade union members, or people who are out there in the community talking about these critical issues. Frank Emspach, the executive director of this program, decided to take this national, and to take the WRT community labor radio model and expand that nationally, and that's what we've done. Thanks in large part to the internet, MP3 file sharing. This has drastically reduced the cost in terms of sharing audio files quickly and getting breaking news out to a national audience. We produce three things on a daily basis. We have a headline news package, which is a 3-minute news feature, which, would be similar, perhaps, to, if people are familiar with free speech radio news, to Randy Zimmerman's headlines. That includes a 30-second, what we call the Dow Bob report. There's the Dow Jones over here, and you turn on the radio and you get news about the Dow Jones. We have the Dow Bob report, which is the labor antithesis of it. Economic news for working people. The stock market goes up. Well, that's great. What does that mean for you? Well, it might not mean such a good thing, Inflation is low. What does that mean? Well, maybe it means that the Fed isn't going to raise interest rates, or maybe they raise interest rates and that affects unemployment. These are things that are not being addressed. And then finally, we have feature stories, which are similar to the free speech radio news style, 3 to 5 minute presentations. And a network of stringers across the United States that we're trying to build, people who can bring stories from their community and put it out to a national audience. So that's just a brief overview of the Workers Independent News Service. We have a number of CDs here. Unfortunately, our brochures didn't make it up here into the Catskills on time. But I'll be happy to tell you all about it. And everyone who's interested in hearing what we have to offer, come up to me at the end of this panel, and I'll be happy to share that with you.
Maybe two pieces of business just before I tell you a little bit about what my concerns are as somebody who's been looking at the issue of the working class and workers, where they live, where they work, and how they organize for at least 30 years now. One, I really have to compliment my brothers here. They have done an enormous service, as far as I'm concerned, throughout the country to try to put together, not to try, but to put together WINS News Service. It is strategic. It is critical. I know the monetary effort, the organizing, and the quality, and I really commend you. It's desperately needed, and I think you do a smashing, committed, dedicated job, and that needs to be said. And then I need to say something else. I don't know how many people here were at the bigger tent a moment ago, and one of the things that happened, I haven't been to the Grassroots Radio Conference for, I guess, 2 years now, and there were reasons that I didn't come. One, of course, had to do with being thrown off the air for a year at WBAI during the Pacifica crisis, but it also had to do with the look and the feel of the conference. Now, I found it very tragic in some ways what happened moments ago, where a brother who I know well and dearly love, a man of African ancestry, had a kind of kick in the door, so to speak, and say, look at us, we're here. Queers are here, gay and lesbians are here, transsexuals are here, black people are here, Latino people are here, Muslim Arab people are here. It's unacceptable for people who consider themselves advocates of the working class and progressives to ever have that happen, where they have to take the responsibility. And what they did was almost immediately vitiated by a woman getting up and saying, but look at the whites, we're oppressed. That's not the issue. If people take their work seriously, the conjuncture of race and class is critical, and it is a responsibility of, I think, the white folks to kick in those doors and kick down their own comfort. It's the responsibility of straight people to become advocates of people who are gay, lesbian, and transgendered. It is not their responsibility to continue in 2002 at progressive media communication conferences to kick in the door and say that they are here. And we better, I think, hard about what we are going to do throughout the rest of this conference to make sure that it has the kind of diversity and sensitivity and representation without people having to grandstand or plead to be allowed at the table, which is what happened in that last big workshop. I'm not trying to guilt trip. I just think that it's part of what organizing and communication is about, and it's the critical part if we're going to build a movement in this country to be transformative and really empower people to take back their resources and use them in a way that's conducive to the needs of their communities. So I felt that it was absolutely necessary to say that. I, too, have CDs, and while a little shameless promotion, myself and my co-host, Ken Nash, have been working for many years to try to put the issues of workers on the agenda and to look at work within a greater conceptual context than I think it normally is, and within a greater geographic context. I'd just like to maybe pass these around. We're trying to put together, a national half-hour labor program. That tape consists of an interview with Dr. Hanna Nosrawi, who I really consider one of the heroines of the Palestinian movement, but all people who champion human rights in the world community. And there's a piece on economic development in South Africa with Hugh Masekela, jazz impresario, and Harry Belafonte and Danny Glover, who are working on a project called Shared Interest to do economic development through primarily small entrepreneurial schemes and cooperative farming in South Africa. And a lot of what they talk about is putting together a Marshall Plan for the development of the both underdeveloped and exploited continent of Africa. And I mention that not just to promote it, but I mention it because when I say that we try to look at labor in a broader context, what I find to be the most trouble, it is a given that there is either no news or distortion of the news of the working class. A wonderful example, a painful example, is just recently in New York for 4.5 weeks, transportation workers, Local 100, the bus workers were out on strike. It was not an easy strike. It's been hot. It's been miserable. It's been 4 weeks. There hasn't been a great deal of receptivity to negotiating with them. It's about job security, and it's about what happens at almost every union now, health givebacks, job security. There were 170,000 workers, consumers in Queens who were similarly inconvenienced by getting to their job because the buses were not running. And these are primarily in venues where people definitely need cars or mobile transportation. They don't have the subway right next to their home. There was maybe one or two stories of any feature and any significance that appeared during a 4 week period of time. It was tragic. So that's almost a given and it's understood. What I find as a harder problem in the years of production that I've been involved with labor pieces is how to get progressive peoples, how to get the communities, how to get the workers to want to listen to and care about worker-oriented programs. They conceive of it almost as a cobwebbed old manifestation of organizing with the Communist Party in the 30s, the Wobblies, etc. There's a stodginess and a death that people and many younger people assimilated in response to labor programming. And I always thought about Toni Morrison's brilliant book, The Bluest Eye, where people affect their own prejudices and assimilate the mentality of the oppressor in the way they look at themselves, and they must free themselves. When we think about the working class or labor radio, we have too many people who, one, don't identify themselves as workers in the society. Youth very often do not identify themselves as workers. They don't think about pensions. They don't think about pension funds. They don't think about health care needs. They don't think about job security, all these issues. And of course, it's been decades since we've kind of divested the collective class consciousness of our society from thinking about people as workers. Consumers get pissed when transportation workers go out on strike because they're pitted against each other. They forget that they similarly are workers and there's a collective interest. So one of the major problems I really find that has to become part of labor programming is the creativity and the way you learn to relate and encourage people to be part of that programming, how it becomes interactive. And I don't mean just by using the net or convergence centers, and it's adorable that steel workers had turtle uniforms on when they were out protesting in Seattle, but that's not sufficient. And that really goes to your point. It is about internalizing the ideas and bringing them out and making people who these issues affect, which is virtually everybody in our society who are workers or aspire to be part of the workforce and are kept out of it, how do they become part of these things? And how do we broaden our conceptualization of work? For example, one of the major trading stocks now is prison labor. When people go into a hip place in New York, Canal Street jeans, to buy dungarees, they're buying, it's called prison blues. Most of them don't realize that they're buying dungarees made by prison labor, which is a major contender now. Unwaged labor is a major contender with waged labor. In New York, of course, and in other places in the country, we have the workfare programs where people in the parks departments have lost their jobs by having indentured workers, in effect, picking up the trash, grooming the grounds, doing all the responsibilities that were done by city workers at one point who have now lost their source of employment. Unwaged labor. More and more of our labor, no matter where we work, we spend more time and we get less compensation pursuant to that time. We are unwaged labor. The reparations movement, which is preparing for a national demonstration in Washington next week, is still that unrequited false promise of from the 40 acres and the mules to unwaged labor, people that are not compensated for the work. The issue of reparations is a human rights issue, but it's primarily also a system of work and the relationship to the work market. The reason I mention these things is because some of what I think engages people in listening to this kind of programming is how it's couched and whether it's creative and whether we begin to look at workers as having human rights concerns, what their lives are in their community and how they mobilize. Are issues of sexual harassment part of it? Is the issue of reparations? Is the issue of the diminution of civil rights? For example, one of the major things that's happening with the longshoremen workers at the ports in California is essentially they are being threatened. Just as we are on a quest against terrorism, we are a quest against workers. They are being told that if they take job actions, in effect, they will be in violation of homeland security. They will be threatening the realities and stabilities of this country. It's the old Taft-Hartley imposition. They have been actually called by the forces of government and threatened about any potential job action as being a betrayal of the interests of security of this country. This is the period. So we have the diminution of civil liberties and we have the diminution of workers' rights. They're complementary. They affect us in very similar ways. And of course we have lives as workers of color, as workers who are women, as workers who are gays and lesbian, etc. I think it is strategic to look at programming in a way that encompasses ourselves as workers in a broader way than we traditionally think about it, which is primarily looking at the issue of job security, wages, benefits, etc., in order to engross people. Now, some of the ways that I think can be effective are beginning indeed to move out of our studios. One, I think it's important to begin to do some highly produced pieces to give it an energy and a drama, to combine it with the spoken word, to combine it with the poetic and instrumental and the people's culture, to do plays, to figure out methods of presentation that are engaging and engrossing. And there's very little highly produced material, for example, that's on the Pacifica stations. Very little. It's mostly talk radio. Part of the reason people like a Studs Terkel or somebody is because there's a story. There's an effervescence and a delivery, but there are stories. We need to do that. Columbus Day is coming up. The issue of Sacco and Vanzetti combines history, the tragedy of workers, the issue of struggle, and there's a brilliant play that's been put together on that. Barbara Ehrenreich now, her, for the first time, as my co-host Ken Nash would point out, you have a labor book on the bestseller list. It's almost unheard of, nickel and dimed. She just got a movie contract, and they've done a play out of it. That's fabulous. We have to begin to think of creative uses of worker-oriented material in order to communicate. And when I say communicate, I will be an unabashed leftist in my understanding of why I do media, and that is both to communicate, to give people a base of information, to organize and to organize for complete and thorough social transformation. That's my purpose. It's an organizing function. It's not a passive function. Now, just lastly, in terms of going out, one of the things we had done is we went to a school. The school was a junior high school on the Lower East Side. And the youth spent a year there writing and producing a musical. And it started from somebody getting in trouble with the principal, and the students decided that they couldn't act as individuals to thwart the influence of the principal, who they thought was acting in a very non-egalitarian and unfair way. And what they did is they talked about forming a student union and acting collectively and bargaining collectively. That's what organized labor is. And that's, of course, what they want to take away from federal workers now, the right to collective bargaining, as that bastard Bush goes out and talks to the mine workers. Give me a break. The only reason mine workers have any safety is because of collective bargaining. But so much for hypocrisy. But these students actually put together a labor pay, and they began to think of themselves in a work context, even as students, as they understood what it meant to do collective organization and vie for their rights, even in the school situation. Another situation, as I said, is covering the issue of reparations and making people think of reparations as not just a human and a civil rights issue, but essentially a system that comes out of a relationship that people had to the labor market. There's a brother by the name of Michael Zinzin, who works out of California. And one of the things that he's done is he's taken microphones to shopping centers, and he's set up a mobile unit there where he engages people at those shopping centers and takes that sound. Some of it is produced, some of it actually goes on the air live. And confronts them. It's almost without the humor involved, a kind of TV Nation Michael Moore style, where you enmesh people in the process and they become the creators of that radio. I think that's an extremely effective mechanism for involving people in this interactive process that's not just a technological process, but an intellectual process that makes them create that sound and makes them interested in what it sounds like and involving other people in listening because it's theirs. They develop a kind of proprietary interest in it. So there are many other things to say about the idea of building bridges to the working class, to the working class family, to look at working class issues within the context of neighborhoods, to build bridges across borders and to get workers here to care about what's happening to Pakistani workers, to get them to care what's happening to Palestinian workers who are being starved and curfewed and imprisoned out of their jobs, all of that. And I think we have the kind of minds and energies of, with people like my brothers here, et cetera, and I dare say the audience, to think of how to do it. But that is, I believe, a major task, how to get the materials, get it out there, engage the community, develop a better synergy in creating worker-oriented, working-class-oriented radio and to looking at labor in its full need. As people who have civil, human rights, as well as rights on the job that have to be advocated for. And it's beautiful to be in this gorgeous setting. So thank you.
My name is Norm Stockwell. I'm with WORT Radio. And I thought I would talk about a specific model of how we put together our labor program at WORT. I know there's other people out here who also do labor programs. Ken and Mimi do a wonderful one on WBAI, which is also available on the internet. Dan Toomey here does one in Western Massachusetts on a multilingual station, and maybe some other people. David, you do one in Boston?
Out of Cambridge.
I'll talk about our model and how we created our show, and this is why I didn't want to let John steal too much of my talk, because then I wouldn't have anything to say. We started out. We decided we wanted a voice for labor on our community radio station. And it was kind of hard, first of all, to figure out how to do it. It started out with just a person who got on and talked about labor issues once a month on our morning talk show. And then a bunch of us sat down together, and we sat down in a very conscious way. Frank Emsbeck from the School for Workers, the folks at the South Central Federation of Labor, which is our district labor council, myself from the community radio station, and some folks who do an environmental program for the University of Wisconsin that's distributed on cassette all around the country. And we sat down and said, what would it look like to put together a labor program that would air weekly, that would be in this kind of sort of modular form? And from that, we developed the 15 minutes every other week that we did at 8:15 in the morning, again, dropped into an existing morning show. It, as all of you know who are at community stations, it takes a very large shoehorn to get new programming into the schedule. And the way that we did it was over a long process. So we were in this 15-minute slot for a couple of years. And then from that, we made a proposal for a half-hour program. We did some research about when would be a good time to have this program. It seemed in the Madison community, people were interested in having it at the end of the work week, so it could talk about what happened during that week and also so people have a chance to kind of relax and listen to it. So we picked a Friday evening, 5:30 to 6. Then we went about putting together the program, and we decided there's a lot of labor programs around the country that are commentary programs. They're discussion, debate, talking heads shows, basically. And we wanted to do something that was headline news format, that had news of interest to the everyday lives of working people in our community. We wanted it to be locally based. We wanted to have the voices of labor management, that is the South Central Federation of Labor, the heads of the different unions, but we also wanted the voices of the rank and file working people to be represented. We put together a team of volunteers to put this show on, made up of community radio people and local union folks who had no community radio experience whatsoever. And then we set up a structure for the show, which was headlines, features, a cultural segment, and that's why I grabbed these two David Rovick CDs off of here. There's a bunch of wonderful, wonderful people around the country right now doing labor music, and you don't hear them on the radio. Working people don't get a chance to hear them because their radios are usually tuned to the commercial stations, which play the same five songs over and over again. So we did a series of features about particular topics of labor history with a particular artist. So we had, here's Utah Phillips talking about Mother Jones. Here's Billy Bragg doing something from the Mermaid Avenue album, the songs of Woody Guthrie that were previously unreleased. Here's David Rovics doing a song about an issue, I forget which one we used of his, it's not on these CDs. And so that was a part of the program. Then we wanted to have something that would be useful in a very, very simple way. We did a feature that we called the Legal Moment that would explain some arcane piece of labor law in simple terms. We had stuff on how to get unemployment compensation, health and safety issues. We had a professor at the university who would take this piece of labor law and distill it down into about a 1.5 to 2 minute easy to digest commentary. And then we wanted to have something to activate people, and so we wanted calendar announcements, upcoming issues, events, things that were happening in the community that would be of interest to working people. So we put all this package together, and then how are we going to deliver it? Well, we have two voices, usually a male and a female, local union members, oftentimes people that have no other connection to media whatsoever, and they read the news interspersed with pre-recorded interviews and these legal moments and these culture features. Now, one of the early hurdles that we discovered, and we've been doing this half-hour show for 4 or 5 years now, one of the early hurdles that we discovered is it's really hard to get union people to talk to you. Even though we come in and we say, we're Labor Radio. We're going to report on your issues. They're so used to being burned by the media, to being misquoted. And there's also a little bit of hierarchy in the union movement that somebody down here doesn't want to talk without the approval of somebody up here, and somebody up here doesn't want that person down there to talk. So you have to break through all that. You've got to build a lot of trust. And we did that by going to events, the Bean Feed, the Labor Day picnic, the annual, or excuse me, the monthly Fed meeting, and just be a presence there and get to know people, get people to know the faces of our reporters. And then the other thing we did is we brought in people from like the building trades. We had a whole series we did where we had somebody from the carpenters, somebody from the painters, et cetera, come in and talk about why it's important to be in a union. What does it mean to be a unionized carpenter? And they would talk about pay rates, they would talk about health and safety issues, they would talk about quality of work. And so then you build this relationship, this trust. And over, you know, the 4 or 5 years, we've had some 300 different people now that have been interviewed on our Labor Radio program about an issue, about an event, about something that people need solidarity on, like an upcoming picket or a some kind of event where there's something going on in the labor community that people want to get the word out about. We bring them in to talk about that, or we do a news story about it, or we do a telephone interview about it. And now what's happened is people call us and they say, oh, we've got this event coming up. We'd like you to do it on your labor show. But it took a lot of trust building to get to that point. Another thing that we did that was really interesting, I think, as a model is we would fax to the local media at the end of each show. We would fax out a list. These are the topics we covered on Labor Radio. These are the people that we interviewed. These are their phone numbers. And what we found after doing that for a while is the presence of labor, not just on our station, but across the media in Madison, the presence of labor increased. And the reason was because you have these reporters, particularly at the newspapers, that have the same Rolodex they thumb through every time they want to do a story. And we were giving them additional names. We were giving them information and context, and they were following up on those. And the perspective was broadening as a result of that. The third thing that happened that I think was a really important benefit of getting this whole system going was we built media literacy in the labor community in Madison. We began to give people tools to deconstruct the media messages they were getting from the corporate media. People looked at how we covered an issue. They looked at how Channel 3 television covered the issue, and they could see the difference, and they could begin to deconstruct the way that their story was getting told on commercial media and to respond to it. And so we had a lot of pressure being put on commercial media by working people who are beginning to understand that the media is not always your enemy and the media doesn't always have to portray you incorrectly. So all of these things grew out of a really simple idea, which was getting the voices of working people on the air on community radio. And so I'll go back to the very beginning. In fact, what Errol Maitland was talking about in the opening keynote address about diversity, that a lot of times in our community radio stations, we have a very narrow sort of spectrum of what we have on the air. Maybe we're a radio station in Manhattan. Well, where are the voices of farmers? Where are the voices of people in rural communities? In our case, you know, Madison, Wisconsin is mostly a college town, college and state government. Where are the voices of working people? Where are the stories of the industrial working class? They're there, but they're not on the radio. So bringing that kind of diversity into our community radio stations, in addition to the other very important diversity that Mimi addressed here, which is racial and ethnic diversity, which cuts across these issues of farm and labor and everything else. But I think that we as community radio people need to look at what are the areas that we're not covering and how do we bring those in. So we want to open it up for questions and comments, and maybe other people that are doing labor programs can tell us some of the stories of what you all do as well.
I'd like to bring in a subject of discussion. One thing that...
We can pass. Why don't we pass one around?
Here, we'll use this one.
One with a long wire.
Right. This one.
Here, John.
Oh, that's the one.
One of the things that we face, I do a program that Dan Tomey, UMass Lowell, WJUL. We do a program that the focus of the program is the community, the workplace, and the environment. We have 1 hour in Spanish where we have some of the local Latino community that does a Spanish hour, and then we do an hour in Cambodian because we have a very large Southeast Asian population. But one of the things that I'm facing, the people that I, you know, do our show are all volunteers, is sustainability. You know, how, I mean, all the great ideas of how we do creative radio takes a lot of time. It, you know, I mean, creativity takes time. And, you know, how do people make a living and be able to spend the amount of time that it takes to do, you know, a really creative show. You know, those are the kind of issues that I'd like to find out. You know, who's doing it? I know in Madison they're obviously making a living and they're going nationwide and they're bringing in funding. I have like a little bit better than zero funding. We managed to do a show for 4 years that way, but volunteer work lasts for just a limited amount of time, and I think that's something that we all face. I wondered if anybody else has that issue and has some suggestions on how they've addressed it.
Dan, could I, aside from picking up, of course, and utilizing wonderful services like WINS, there needs to be much greater cross-fertilization. I mean, one of the things we should have doing here is just even the names going around, because we should utilize each other's materials. There are people who, whether it's paid or even unpaid, who do regular work around the country. And there's no reason through the internet now, et cetera, though there's still some stations that aren't able to function either with the internet or taking things down from a satellite and need CDs sent to them or DATs or what have you. But we really can't create a cross-fertilization. Even if we made a list here of the kind of material that people produce, it could be distributed and sent to each other. That's one way I think we could be much more effective in terms of covering a broad swath of issues that are germane in a number of different places. The other things that, and this takes time too, but it seems pretty strategic, is beginning a partnership process. There are labor education schools in a lot of different venues, and classes can commence beginning to teach people at least to do radio. And even if they produce things for a semester as part of a project, they are still doing it, and that becomes material that similarly can be fed into the station. The other thing that we're trying to do at BAI is create internship programs where we do have young people coming in who are fascinated and stimulated by the internet and the whole digitalization process, and begin to have them do short pieces, which similarly can be put over the airwaves. And at least that supplements some of the full-time labor or relatively full-time but unwaged labor that's there producing these things. But I would certainly advocate that what comes out of here is that we share the programming and programmatic resources that we have. And would like to also say that one other thing was very important. I think it was the first time, actually, after 30 years, I'm rather embarrassed to say, that it suddenly occurred to me that aside from banana workers in Guatemala getting shot down and things of that, I thought I've never done anything on our own farmers here, and discovered that... much to my dismay, there are black farmers. The black family farms, there are only 1,500 of them left in the entire country. And between them, they get roughly $25 million distributed versus agribusiness, which, of course, gets billions. and suddenly began to look at that also again as an issue of, it was an issue of reparations. It's still the 40 acres and the mule, the false promises that were made, and got them involved with the national reparations movement, and they are coming up to Washington for the next week. A demonstration that's going to be held around reparations, and the reparations folks began to see the issue of the black farmers and the loss of the family farms as an issue of work. And so we do build a lot of bridges, but I really would like to, I'm going to take this pad here, and maybe what people can do is not only sign on, but sign on about the material and resources they have. And we can figure out some ways of cross-fertilizing and exchanging that, which would replicate ourselves without having to replicate the work involved in putting additional material on the air.
Talking about the issue of volunteers, of course, WINS, where John works, is on a slightly different model because we've actually set that up connected to the university, and we can actually pay wages and benefits to this production staff, which is very different from the community radio world. Our labor radio program is all volunteer produced. It's all volunteers that work on the show. And one of the things that we've done to create sustainability is we've divided out tasks. So we have like a local union member takes on the task of coordinating the readers. Each week, she calls down a list of people and gets two people to come in and read for that week. And so the readers rotate, you know, this week it's these two people, this week it's these two people, and she's the volunteer coordinator of that. Another volunteer coordinates the calendar announcements. They call around to the different groups, they look at newsletters, and they put together the listing of calendar announcements. Other volunteers meet and take on different reporting tasks each week. And so that way we kind of try to not have people have to be involved in every single show. It broadens out the support for the show. It also ends up broadening out the listenership because you get all these different readers and they tell their friends, oh, listen, I'm going to be reading the news on next Friday evening. And so you actually increase listenership that way as well.
You had a question back here.
I had a question and a comment. In regard to your comment, I don't know if you've read Benjamin Barber, but one of the most significant things that he said that impacted me was, you know, we expect government to fix our problems. It can't fix our problems. We expect the market to fix our problems. Can't fix our problems. But civil society, and unfortunately, volunteers, that's really where it's at. That we have to just keep, you know, just keep working at it. It can be enjoyable. Volunteer experiences are wonderful. Anyway, I wanted to say, who was it that was talking about the music? Was it the music? Have you ever had have you had Charlie King and Len Wallace?
Yeah, I know Charlie King well.
Len Wallace.
Len. But we use Len's one of Len's songs as one of our theme pieces.
And David Lipman.
Yeah.
And Ann Feeney. When you were talking about the situation of the Walmarts in Houston,
right.
Was it because you remembered Charlie King's song about that experience?
Well, not in particular. I mean, I just brought up Walmart because I think it's really a symbol of, you know, corporate greed in the United States today. And it's also a symbol of anti-union success on the part of employers. I mean, that corporation in the United States is 100% union free.
Yeah. I just thought the song itself is so, I mean, the stories, that each song is a story, and it's so easy to remember the situations when you hear his music.
Down here and then back there.
A couple of little pieces. One question. You've been working on this project in Madison for 4 or 5 years, it sounds like.
Well, our local labor show on WRT, we've been working on the idea for 10 years. It's been on the air in its current form for 4 or 5.
Have you succeeded or thought about getting any kind of support for the program, for a staff for it, from any of the local labor organizations? Have you gotten to that point?
Yeah. Just to talk about our structure at WRT, all the programmers on air are volunteers on all of our programs. And so we don't actually have staff support for individual programs except volunteers. But what we do is every time our pledge drive comes around, we send out a mailing to all the local labor unions saying, you know, over the last 12 months, we've had so-and-so many people on, we've covered such-and-such an issue, and if your union can make a call of support during our pledge drive, it's going to be October 9th to the 21st. Please call 256-2001. And then we also...
Do you have a labor underwriter for the show?
No, we actually don't have underwriting for specific programs. We have underwriting, but it's not for specific shows. We just but that is both of those are good models, and I know that they are used on labor programs elsewhere in the country with some success.
Another question I have: I was active in the labor movement in the 70s and 80s, and I'm not anymore. I recall the preponderance of left organizations that purported to be organizing workers in those days. And I stumbled across several times in traveling in the last year on community or college radio stations in different areas of the country, a labor program sponsored by, I don't even know what organization, but some vestigial organization from those days. And I'm wondering if anybody knows what that's about and how that fits into the discussion that's happening here.
Hmm. Do you happen to remember the name of the program?
I don't. But it definitely was clearly one of those organizations I remembered hearing and reading about 20 years ago. Nobody knows what I'm talking about.
Sorry, I'm afraid
not. You're talking about 20 years ago, but not the current situation.
I was hoping there were more vestigial organizations that were exploiting the issue of workers so we could get more labor programming. I haven't seen... Yeah. As a matter of fact, programs are being removed. And that's in stations are in serious jeopardy right now. And more programming. As a matter of fact, Ken, wasn't there another labor program that just crashed recently?
Well, the Loyola University program is in trouble. I mean, all the programs are Loyola and Kansas City.
Right.
I'm
right.
Not quite sure what's happening with that at this point. They're both still on, but both of those stations are under attack. And it's okay.